Dublin's Talking Sport.
Welcome to Dublin's Talking Sports podcast with me, Ken Doherty, and my good friend, Reggie Corrigan. Thanks for tuning in to catch up on the latest GAA, football, rugby, and all the crack. Enjoy the show, and don't forget, rate and review wherever you get your podcasts.
Another great show for you this week on Dublin's Talking Sport. Ken caught up with John Parrott and discusses his recent retirement with him. I caught up with Mike Ruddock, former Grand Slam winning rugby coach for the Welsh Rugby. Another great show for you here on Dublin's Talking Sport this week. Ken Doherty caught up with John Parrott and discussed his decision recently to retire from the game. I caught up with former Grand Slam winning rugby coach Mike Ruddock to talk about the state of play in Welsh rugby and a few things going on over there that are interesting to say the least. Sean Lane was in studio to discuss everything that's happening in GAA, and Aisling Cleary, PRO of the Leinster Ladies Gaelic Football Association, is on too to discuss Dublin's chances against Meath in their game this evening. And as always, Alan Cawley joined me to discuss the SSE Airtricity League and a really exciting few games last night that means there's just one point between Derry City and Shamrock Rovers at the top of the league. So download the show now wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, Reg. How are you?
I'm great. Absolutely wonderful. Had a great week last week watching you guys on the TV and watching all the snooker. And what a final we had. You predicted the final, and it was, as you said, it would be. But what a game it was.
It was incredible, wasn't it?
It was brilliant. I mean, in fairness to Trump, it was glued to snooker. He must have been exhausted after that epic battle against Williams. And he was kind of went into a bit of a slump at the beginning of it, but he battled back brilliantly.
He did, yeah. He came back. Well, he won the third session 6-2. From 12-5, he came back to 14-11. Got actually within two at one stage. And yeah, it was brilliant. You know, he played really well and showed a lot of great qualities. And I thought, like, you know, the final session, 14-11, right, we're going to have a real match here. And if you can come out and win, you know, two of the first, like, three frames, then anything can happen, you know. But O'Sullivan was just imperious. You know, he played in the final session. Honestly, it was like watching him in the snooker club. He's got this innate ability just to play so casually and so freely, you know, in the heat of battle, when it means so much and there's so much at stake. And he just coasted to victory in the end. Like, it was an easy final for him. It was just brilliant to watch, you know.
Yeah, it was. And as I said, Trump worthy opponent, but just kind of ran out of steam at the end. It was a funny sort of a game, you know. Like you said, Ronnie went surging into the lead and then Trump came back into it. And it seemed Ronnie was getting a little bit snippy at times as well. I know a few of our listeners were wondering. What was that thing with the ref? I mean, I watched it at the time. I couldn't really see. It was like the ref accused him of doing something that Ronnie got annoyed with because he didn't do anything.
Exactly. Well, during the World Championship, I think in the first round, he made a sort of a hand gesture when he missed the pot. And I think they were sort of on a lookout for him to do it again because they didn't see it in the first play and became apparent, you know, through Twitter and social media that people were sending tweets and showing Ronnie making a hand gesture. This was in the very first round of the tournament on, like, day one, you know. So in the final, the referee said that he saw him make another hand gesture when he missed the pot, and he went over and he warned him. Now, I felt that he could have warned him because it was a critical stage and it was only in the fourth frame. Yeah. So he could have waited until the interval, because you have a little interval after four frames, and it was sort of a very important time in that fourth frame where Judd Trump had a yellow to try and win the match. And Ronnie said he didn't do anything. He said, check the monitors, don't start. He says, don't start on this. And, you know, it was the right argy-bargy, but it was ongoing. He wouldn't shake his hand, Ronnie, at the end of the session. And another incident where the referee was putting the cue ball back, he never left his cue off the table. So the referee had to get under his cue to see was the white and light. He hit his head off Ronnie's cue. It was quite funny, you know.
Right.
But at the same time, it was, there was a bit of needle between himself and the referee throughout the whole match, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch. Mm. I mean, it seems that he does, because I suppose he has been controversial in the past. And
yeah, he has. Yeah.
So they're trying to watch it. But...
And they don't, nobody likes to see that, like, on TV, by a top sportsman in any way, you know. So trying to cut it out, he's quite impetuous at times, Ronnie, and he has to be reined in every now and again. But he was just brilliant, absolutely brilliant, you know. And like, the funny thing about this final and throughout this championship, Reg, that he's had this film crew following him around, like, for the whole, like, they've been following him around for the last 6 months, but they've been making a documentary, a fly in the wall documentary with him. And apparently he's been mic'd up for this whole of the World Championship, even when he was playing, like, he was wearing a radio mic,
right,
which is quite incredible, you know. So the fact that he's equal Stephen Hendry's record, 7 World Championships now as well, I mean, what an end to that documentary, and how sort of interesting that documentary is going to be. Not that it wasn't going to be already, but the fact that he's toppled, you know, everybody's won the World Championship, he's equal to Hendry's record, he's become the greatest player that we've ever seen, and we'll never see the likes of another Ronnie O'Sullivan. There's no doubt about that. He's just been a very, very special player, you know.
And you know what's going to be really interesting about that documentary, if it comes out in it, is going to be the embrace at the end. I mean, when he was hugging Trump, it went on forever. It was almost getting uncomfortable in the end.
It wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, you were kind of saying, is he having a bit of a breakdown or a meltdown here? It's like, has the emotion got to him, or what's going on? But I presume, that's if he's mic'd up, what he's saying to Trump and Trump back to him will be there on tape. It'd be great if they put that in the documentary.
Absolutely, yeah. It was a bit... I mean, watching the man hug at the end, it was getting a little... Okay, for a little while, it's not too bad, but it went on for a couple of minutes, like, you know. I think even Judge Trump was the same, almost saying to him, you get off me now, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Where are you, Ronnie?
I know, yeah. It was quite weird, like, you know, but that's the type he is, you know.
It just seemed like emotion got him. It seemed like...
Yeah, and you never see him like that at all, you know.
Yeah, it just felt like he just needed time to... reset and just compose himself before he let go of Trump.
Yeah,
he's almost hiding.
Well, apparently, you know, I mean, we saw the tears after the final, but apparently, even afterwards in the Eurosport studio, he went in there and they had to cut to a break because he broke down. Actually, uncontrollably, tears came out. You know, so they had to cut and go to a break, so to give him time just to get his emotions. So it was probably a build-up of a lot of things. And maybe it wasn't just a build-up of the 2 weeks. It's been a build-up for the last, like, couple of years to try and, you know, emulate what Stephen Hendry has done there, winning 7 World Championships. It's taken him, like, 21 years.
Yeah.
But he, I think it was one that it shows how much he means to him, even though he would try and deflate that and, you know, say that it doesn't, records don't mean that much, but it just shows you how much the whole thing meant. It was a fitting end. I said it to him afterwards at the party. I said, look, your talent, your genius deserves that you win this World Championship. And no one was more happier than me. He's an absolute, it was fantastic. And like BBC, I was just looking at the figures. They peaked at 4.5 million, which is the highest, just on BBC now, the highest for 8 years for the snooker. So it shows you how much he sort of captivates the audience, you know?
Yeah. And Trump as well, after that epic battle against Williams, I suppose people felt there was a chance that he could get the job done too. What now for Ronnie?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody always asks this question. I mean, the obvious thing to everybody else is that he goes on and beats the record and becomes the ultimate that...
Try and win 8.
Like, no. He wouldn't know a Ronnie, though. He's so unpredictable, he could
disappear. I know, you just never know. I mean, 1 year, he won the World Championship, I think it was 2011, and then he came back. He never played the whole season and came back for the following World Championship and ended up winning that as well, you know. So he took the whole year out. But now you don't know what's going to happen. And it'll be interesting, this documentary. I'm sure everybody will be eager to see it when it does come out on Netflix, but... I'd say they could add a few zeros to the contract now after winning the World Championship. But yeah, I don't know. Nobody knows what Ronnie will do. But there's no doubt, I think he will come back and try and win eight. You know, and you know, if he keeps doing what he's doing, you know, it's very hard to see anybody beating him. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about that.
Yeah, yeah.
The championship overall was a huge success, and I know you caught up with John Parrott as well to have a discussion about it. We're going to listen to that clip very shortly, but overall, does everybody feel that it was a good championship? And
it was just amazing.
COVID and all the rest of it.
And the crowds, Reggie, were just fantastic. I mean, it's always been sold out, but I mean, the crowds over here and the amount of Irish that were over here. You know, I was doing a bit of filming on the Saturday, and there must have been about 20 or 30 of Irish that came up to me that had come over for the World Championship, you know, at least just on that day alone, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's over 45,000, I'd say, tickets for the whole 17 days, you know, for three sessions every day are sold. So, it was just an amazing championship. The fact that we had the crowds back after the COVID as well for every session was brilliant as well. And it's just the enthusiasm for them, you know. And that we had a 147, Neil Robertson making a 147 in it, and Ronnie O'Sullivan winning it, which just topped everything off, you know. It was just, it was fantastic, you know.
Before I go to your clip with John Parrott, which I'll do in just a moment, just your thoughts during the week in the football, because we always discuss it.
The
Champions League was incredible. I still am pinching myself over that Real Madrid result. What a game.
Yeah.
Guardiola, shell-shocked. I mean, it was in the bag. It was job done.
Yeah, it was in the bag, yeah. It reminded me a lot of the Champions League final in 99, you know, when United were then buried and they came back and 1-2-1 in the last 9 seconds. It was just incredible, you know, how they lost it. I don't think they deserved to lose it, but and it would have been nice to see Man City in the final against Liverpool in Paris. But Real Madrid, you have to just hand it to them, just the way they kept fighting and fighting and fighting. And it was just it was the two semi-finals, you know. The first one was 4-3. I've never seen a better game of football like that in such a long time. And the dramatic end of this one was just as good. It was just I just hope that they can play as well. I think Liverpool will win the Champions League. I think they'll be too good for them. Yeah. But I just hope it's a great game of football, and I'm sure it will be, you know.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
I feel a bit sorry for Pep, because he's done everything else. You know, he hasn't won that Championship League, the Champions League with Man City, and he's done everything else, you know. And it's just, you feel a bit sorry for him in the end, you know.
You would. I saw a picture of him during the week in a Mayo jersey, and a kind of... they're making the comparisons already. There's no doubt.
I know. It was brilliant show, yeah.
Okay.
I caught up with John Parrott.
What did you get chatting to John about?
Yeah. Well, it's the World Seniors is on, of course, this week. And John Parrott is hanging up his cue. You know, he's been a professional since, I think, 1984.
Yeah.
He won the World Championship, of course, in 91, 31 years ago. And this is it. He's finished playing. And he's just going to concentrate on being a commentator and an analyst, which he's brilliant at as well. But a nicer fella you couldn't wish to meet, Reg. And, it was a nice fitting end to his career last night at the Crucible against Nigel Bond.
Okay. All right, Ken. We'll catch up to you again next week. You take care of yourself.
Okay, Reg. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too. And as Ken said there, he caught up with John Parrott during the week. So let's have a listen to that interview now.
Joining me now at the back of the Crucible, getting ready to play tonight, John Parrott, the 1991 world champion, and of course, BBC compatriot. I say, John, first of all, what a wonderful 2 weeks, 17 days at the Crucible Theatre, and Ronnie O'Sullivan lifting the trophy on Monday night.
It was fabulous, right from start to finish. And you could tell, Ken, couldn't you, because he was focused right from ball one. I know he had a team here doing a documentary with him, and you could see, even when he was 3-0 down in his first match with Dave Gilbert, you could see he was focused. And nobody really got close. I mean, Higgins put it up to him in the semi-final, but he didn't buckle in any way, shape or form. And, you know, he's the best player, and by some way, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even Judd Trump, when he got back to 14-11 for that evening session, we thought there might be a little bit more pressure, but he looked as calm as cool as a cucumber, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, and he pulled away again. He just always looked like there was another gear there, and he was a thoroughly deserving winner.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know about you, but I just felt it was probably fitting for him that he actually gets... It's the only record he doesn't have, you know? And when I saw him afterwards, I said, look, you're genius, your talent, and everything else that goes with
with it, deserves a seven world championship.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can't wait to see Stephen's lip when he wins eight.
That's what he says. He said, I don't mind him sharing it, but as long as you don't get to eight.
Oh, no. When he gets to eight, I'm going to want to see Stephen's lip.
But we'll never, I said it the other day, we'll never see the likes of Ronnie O'Sullivan again.
No, absolutely. No. And to be that talented and to be that good left-handed, I mean, people even forget now. I mean, just throws the cue in the other hand and screws back the reverse side, and we all go, what the heck is that? You know, because we've all played the game.
Yeah,
we know,
course,
I know how the shot is with your own hand.
Yeah, yeah. And so hard here at the Crucible. I mean, we have both great memories here, but you, particularly you in 1991, like, I mean, that was quite special for you. I mean, is that, like, it's obviously the highlight of your career, but does it feel like it's just like yesterday? There's so many great memories of it.
Oh, it seems like miles ago.
Yeah, does
it? Oh, it seems so far. My wife's come for tonight for me, this one song playing here, and she said, oh my God, she said, it was 33 years ago I was here watching you play. I said, you haven't sussed me out yet?
And she hasn't changed a bit.
No, she's still lovely. I've got a little bit different. No, she's lovely. So she's coming for me one song tonight to have a little look. And as I say, 33 years ago she was here watching me. Amazing.
But the Crucible itself, it does special things to players over the years. And we've all got great memories here.
Yeah, you. I mean, you've had some great times here as well. Champion, also some of the comebacks in the semi-finals. Yeah. We've all had them. Great matches you've won. And, you know, the whole thing about this place is the tables are cramped at the beginning, and then the dividing wall comes up and it's yours. And then the semi-finals, it's a totally different venue in so many ways.
I always tell people, like, you know, if you ever get a chance, come here, because the atmosphere is unlike anywhere else.
No, it's electric. And I was a 14-year-old boy when I sat in where the press boxes used to be, where the bookend is. I was playing in a junior event, and Mike Watterson got two tickets for me and my dad to get in. I don't know how my dad wangled it, but he did. And we sat there and we watched Cliff Thorburn play Doug Mountjoy, and I was immediately hooked, and I went, yep, this is what I want to do. I want to play. The atmosphere was electric. Very, very hard to describe.
Now tell me, 33 years on, we're playing the World Seniors, you're going out to play Nigel Bond tonight. Hopefully you get through, but this is going to be you're going to retire after this year, after this particular championship.
Yeah, I don't mind. Listen, if I lose tonight to Bondy, what a lovely lad to go out to.
Because he's
one of the nicest lads on tour. Yeah. But listen, I've had my fill of playing. I still love the game. I still like watching, talking about it. I just can't be bothered putting the hours in to be competitive. Can I live next door to the 18th of Formby? There's too many golf courses to play.
It's too nice.
There's too many golf courses to play. So, no, I've had a great run at it. Thoroughly, you know, I still love watching the game, and we all do. And we have great fun. And the people at home should know we actually have that much fun. We shouldn't really be getting paid.
Yeah, no, but it's great, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So something's very special for you tonight after... what year was it? How long have you been professional?
Turned pro in
1984.
I've been retired from the professional circuit when I was, 12 years ago. But no, just listen, this circuit, we hope this takes off.
Absolutely.
And I don't want to take someone's place of someone who genuinely wants to compete and play on it.
Okay.
So I've had my fill, I've had my go at it. Let someone else take my place.
Well, listen, deserving. I hope you go out with a big bang, John. And hopefully we see you on Sunday night in the final as well. That'd be even more special.
Listen, I've walked 100 miles in the Dales, I've done all my push-ups, all my press-ups. No, I haven't. I went for three glasses of wine in the Dales.
Well, listen, the best of luck. And it's been a pleasure knowing you and playing with you over the years as well. And good luck tonight in your swan song.
Pleasure, Ken.
It's time to turn our attention to rugby now. Welsh rugby, to those of us on the outside looking in, can be somewhat of a mystery. At national level, they can go on and win games, win Grand Slams and perform well in World Cups. But when it comes down to it, at regional level, they really haven't performed to the levels that they would have expected. Just six titles in the history of the URC, the last one going back to 2016 when the Scarlets lifted the trophy. I'm delighted to be joined on the line now by a man who won a Grand Slam as coach of Wales in 2005, beating me in the game that day, which he is always happy to tell me about, but a former coach of mine and a great friend as well. I'm delighted to welcome to the show Mike Ruddock. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Bonada, Reggie. Good morning to you and everyone in Dublin. How are you?
We're all wonderful. Absolutely great. Great to have you on the show. I know you were at a rugby dinner last night, so I appreciate it even more that you've taken the time to be with us this morning. But I have to start by just talking to you about a few things that happened during the week. You're ideally placed to maybe fill in some of our Irish listeners here on what's happening in Welsh rugby. I saw Pontypool during the week their game with Badoo RFC was cancelled because Beto couldn't field a team or something like that. But they were calling for the Pontypool were calling for Beto to be thrown out of the championship and also for the entire WRU game board to resign. What's going on over there?
Just another week in Welsh rugby, Reggie, as you know. Just another week in Welsh rugby. By the way, I hope you haven't reversed the charges on this call.
No, we'll take the pay on this one.
Yeah, we're building a new extension, so things are tight at the moment, Reggie. But no, it's just another week in Welsh rugby. And, you know, I've gone on record before as saying that, you know, we're quite a unique country. You know, our rugby traditionally was based on a bit like the GAA, you know, the parish sort of concept and the tribalism and the rivalry between the different towns and cities and parishes, you know. And, you know, there's always been a lot of emotion in Welsh rugby, and probably the only time all those tribes have come together is to support the national team or under one of our famous Welsh chieftains years ago, we came together to defeat the Romans. But other than that, we tend to fight each other quite a bit, you know. And, of course, what's happened since the... you know, since the evolution of the internet and of, you know, clickbait on the internet and news stories, clickbait on news stories online, sensationalized sort of headlines tend to go far and wide, hence your phone call today. So, look, the story around Pontypool, it's most unfortunate that their season was disrupted. But, you know, I've looked back on the story and what was pretty clear from the Welsh Rugby Union's side of things was that as they were coming out of the pandemic, they felt that there would be a number of games that would be called off and the fixture list could be disrupted due to COVID. And they said right at the start of the season that, look, if somebody can't fulfill a fixture, it's just the way it's going to be this year. And that's what's happened, I think, to Bather. Rugby club, you know, they were unable to fulfil their fixture with Pontypool, and that disadvantaged Pontypool. The key thing here, I think, Reggie, is that there's been a couple of seasons where Pontypool have been sort of champions and trying to get out of that tier that they're in, the championship sort of tier, up to what's called the Premiership, and the Premiership has been ring-fenced, you know, right? So I think there's three or four attempts here that have gone south, and I think that's the underlying frustration rather than just this one fixture or this one season, you know?
Okay, fair enough. Well, then, you know, if we move it up the levels then, Mike, there's also talk during the week that the Welsh Union are looking at reducing the regions from four down to three and possibly making those three regions more competitive than they have been. Because let's face it, you know, your national game, rugby, you won a Grand Slam in 2005. There's been various successes at national level for Wales. In the subsequent years, you know, they've always been a team that have been extremely difficult to beat, champions 2 years ago and not such a good season this year. But, you know, it seems like a bit of a basket case at times, though. How can it be good at national level yet falling apart so much at regional level?
Great question, Reg. How long have you got to answer that one? Well, look, the first thing I want to say on that is I'm a big believer in the power of coaching. And, you know, normally the winning teams are the best coach teams. And I think people like Warren Gatland and Sean Edwards have proven that despite some of the underlying and underpinning difficulties in Welsh rugby, when they get a squad together and build team spirit and good fitness and good technical ability, that you're still able to, you know, to win games regardless of you know the performance of the regional teams. And you could say the same for Ireland, really, you know. That you know, even in times when Ireland weren't winning you know, the European Cup every year, the Irish rugby team that you would have played in, Reg, you still believed when you went out there with the coach that you could win the games, you know, and you did. So I still believe that, you know, the power of coaching is massive. So there's that issue. So, you know, have we given the environment to allow our coaches to, and the support to allow our coaches at regional level to flourish, and the stability over time to allow them to flourish. You know, there's been a lot of instability traditionally in Welsh rugby, and coaches haven't lasted too long, you know. I'd like to think that part of the job I had when I came back to the Ospreys was to appoint a really good coach, and I'd like to think we did that with Toby Booth. I'd like to think that we are now giving him the opportunity and stability to develop this team to win something like six. So the Ospreys can be a championship team before too long. And I think you mentioned that Welsh teams have won something like six league championships. And I think most of those have been the Ospreys.
Four have been the Ospreys, two have been the Scarlets.
Yeah, when we had stability around our coaching team, yeah. Lynn Jones, who was a local lad who did fantastic things with the Ospreys. You know, I think he won three or four of those titles, perhaps all of those titles. So I think that's what we need. We need that bit of stability around the coaching, and then you can get success. The Scarlets did it with Wayne Pivak, and gave him a lot of support. He got a lot of success, and then went on to be the Welsh coach. And then the following year, Brad Moore, I think, or within 2 years, had built on that work and had won the championship with the Scarlets. And, of course, our own Tyke Byrne, who I coached in Lansdowne in the under-20s, went to play for the Scarlets. They won the league. I remember watching them beating Leinster, I think, in the semi-final or the final.
That's right.
At the Aviva.
2016, yeah.
100%. And then Brad Moore leaves. You see, Reg, and since then they've gone through two or three coaches. So, you know, I think that's what the regions need. They need more stability around the coaching to give good coaching the chance to come through. The other thing they need, of course, and one of what has blighted Welsh rugby is probably the financials of each of the regions. You know, there hasn't been the same buy-in to the regions that there has been in Ireland for the provincial teams, which are clearly, earmarked on historical basis geographically around your four provinces. You know, so I don't think everyone's bought into the amalgamation, if you like, the manufactured regions, and that's still an ongoing challenge. So, having said that, Reg, you know, I've come back. There's a lot of talented players I see in Welsh rugby, particularly in and around the Ospreys, and part of what I'm doing is helping to develop players to come through our pathway. We're strengthening Swansea University. I bring a lot of players, particularly Welsh qualified players. I attract them into Swansea University, so we've got a second pool of talent. Because what I learned in over and above our academy, because what I learned from all my time in coaching in Ireland, Reg, is it's a numbers game. So when you and I first started off in Leinster back in 97, we would have had quite a small pool of players to choose from. There was no Leinster Academy. There was, the universities were perhaps not the level they're at now, where there was a proper rugby program in each one of those top universities. But now, when I left in, 2020, I left Lansdowne. You know, by then, UCD were running a terrific rugby program under Tony Smith. Trinity were under Tony Smith. Yeah. UCD were running a very competitive rugby program in 1A. The Leinster Academy was overproducing to the tune that some of the players were going to other academies or off to England. So it became a numbers game. The schools were vibrant and producing lots of players. You know, Welsh rugby has got to get to that point where we're overproducing in our pathway, and that will give us sustained success. And Reg, I guess the bottom line with that is you need some financial stability. And what happened there during the pandemic, which is crucial to all these stories, I guess, and what I want your listeners to understand a little bit more, really. Crucial to all of this is that when the pandemic hit, the Welsh Rugby Union, you know, lost their income streams through crowds coming into the stadium for internationals. The regions lost their income streams. So we had to borrow between us all 20 million, 5 million each, if you like, for each of the four regions that was going to have to be paid off in 3 years. Now, that's just been extended to 20 years.
Right.
What that means, Reg, I guess the bottom line here, what that means is, by reducing that burden, that debt over a longer period, it gives us more money to invest in our coaching, in our environment, in our systems, to produce better players over the longer term. So I think those are the challenges we've had. Whereas if you look at Irish rugby, even though you've been hit with the same pandemic and you've had the same sort of challenges, you've had a lot more support from Irish government around funding. You've had a lot more stability around your coaching, and you've had a lot more stability financially and structurally around the way the game is governed in Ireland. And I think probably we've had a total difference in the parallels around those in Wales and Ireland. But hopefully, when Nigel Walker has just come in as the new performance director, a really good man, Nigel. He played international rugby for Wales. He was head of the UK sport body, governing body. So I think now we've got a figurehead that can help us to shape things and make sense of some of these difficulties. And, you know, part of this new commission sort of report you talked about was to come up with a recommendation that helps give us that stability and that financial stability over time to build those systems.
Yeah. Well, it certainly, you know, it sounds like there are things in place to try and fix things over there. But there is also a mention during the week that they were going to go from four regions down to three. That would seem like a backward step to me. Is there any credence in that, or is it just, again, a bit of clickbait being put out there?
Yeah, well, it is one of six recommendations that I understand have been put forward in a report commissioned by the Professional Rugby Board. So there's a number of boards in Wales that oversee the game. So going back to Pontypool's story that you mentioned earlier, that was the community game board that run that particular aspect of the community game. Pontypool wanted to sort of get that board to resign. So that's a totally different board. They run the semi-pro and the community clubs. Whereas Premier Rugby Board, PRB, would run the professional game, and that would basically be a member of each one of the four regions, plus a member of the Welsh Rugby Union. So you got all five professional entities, and then you would have a couple of independent people on there as well. And they commissioned a report, and the report to get rid of a region, or the recommendation to get rid of the region, was just one of six possible recommendations or options available to the Professional Rugby Board. Now, Reg, you remember, and I remember, when everyone wanted in Ireland, the RFU thought about getting rid of Connacht.
Yeah.
And the whole province took to the streets and marched down the road and made it very clear that that was not a good idea. Mm. And Connacht and the Pat Lamb went on to win the URC or the Celtic League.
Yeah.
You know, and look at all the players they've produced to Irish rugby now. And the players they brought in, the exiles like Mark Hansen, I think is the winger who's setting the game on fire.
Yeah.
You know, it is still a numbers game. I think I mentioned that earlier, Reg. So I think getting rid of one of our regions would be a big mistake when I'm trying to push the idea through the Welsh channels that it is a numbers game. And Ireland, the Irish model have proved that, like you said, back in 97, we'd lost a lot of players to England, Conor O'Shea, Malcolm O'Kelly, Eric Miller, all those guys that you know and played with had gone to England. We started to get some of those guys back. We started to get our academy in Ireland up and running in each of the four regions. We started to get better programs in the clubs and in the universities. And all of a sudden, the numbers went up. And particularly when you guys, Reg, when you were captain in Leinster and you went on TV in the Celtic League, that really sparked everything in, as far as I can see in Ireland, you know, in terms of numbers. And once the numbers went up, the numbers of spectators went up at the RDS. Reg, you remember when we beat Leicester in 97, it was in the first European Cup game in Donnybrook.
Mm.
I remember the Leinster branch patting me on the back. We had 8,000 people, they said.
Yeah.
8,000 people watching us beat Leicester. We never had such a great crowd. Fantastic. Now, it's Leinster take those games to the Aviva Stadium. 50,000 people. So it's a numbers game off the field as well. So, you know, I think those are the lessons that I'm trying to convey. We've got to keep numbers in Wales. We've got to just be honest with ourselves, which we are doing, and you guys are right to look over the water and ask us, what are we going to do about it? And what we're going to do about it, I think, is we've got to look closely at these recommendations come out of it the other side in a stronger way. But I personally think losing a region and losing numbers would be the wrong way to go.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. Okay, well, while you're over there bringing the Ospreys forward back to being the great team that they once were with the four titles that they won, you're also keeping an eye on things here. Of course, your son Reese on the bench today for Leinster in the Champions Cup. They've got a big game away to Leicester. How do you see that one going? I mean, we obviously were a bit biased, you and I, but it's going to be a tough one against Leicester, isn't it?
Well, it will be tough. And again, you remember when you and I went there, we went there in the European Cup and we turned them over at Welford Road all those years ago. Mm. And I remember we put a big focus on defending lineouts 5 metres out. You know, Martin Johnson, those boys, they're going to come at you. The crowd are going to be, very passionate when they get you in that red zone. So I think, again, even those 20, 30 years later, those elements are still the same. I think it'll be a lot of nip and tuck, and I think there'll be a lot of influential moments in around the middle of the park. But I think it'll be who comes out of those red zone exchanges the best under pressure will win this game. And I'd have to say that you'd have to say, even though it's a very difficult venue to get a result in, Leinster should win. My only concern, Reg, is that the lads haven't really played together for a number of weeks, and will they just be quite on the money, So that'll be the unknown for me. Otherwise, Leinster's technical ability, their mental strength, their professionalism, and their experience of going to these venues should stand by them,
Yeah, we have a few Munster listeners living in Dublin as well. They've got to lose, of course. They've had to come up the road here because Ed Sheeran has taken over down in Thomond. But they have a tough one against Toulouse. Given that home advantage from Thomond Park away, it'll make it all the tougher.
Yeah, and I always keep a really good eye on Munster, Reg, because my mother, God bless her, was a lovely Munster lady from County Clare, a little town village called Kildicet. So I very often pop down there sentimentally, have a beer down there on my travels. So I always keep an eye on the Munster, results, of course. And you're right, it's going to be a tough one against Toulouse. They're so talented. And normally I'd say it'll be a breeze, really, beating a French team, even though it's in Europe, in Ireland, in the winter. But when you get a sunny day, when you get a sunny day and there's a bit of flow in the game, then obviously Toulouse can be, hugely exciting to watch and incredibly effective with their open space continuity, So, but I think from what I've seen and heard about the Munster vibe, I think Munster will be fine.
GAA now, delighted to be joined in studio by Sean Lane. Morning, Sean, how are you?
Morning, Reg, how are you keeping?
Oh, keeping great, never better. Some great sport going on, and no doubt last week was good as well, right across the board in GAA terms. The footballers got back to winning ways pretty comprehensively, actually, against Wexford. Declan caught up with Desi Farrell afterwards. Let's just have a listen to what they had to say.
Desi Farrell, Dublin manager, joins us here in the tunnel at Wexford Park. 23 point victory in the end. A pleasing night's work all around.
Yeah, we're pleased with it. It's the first round of championship for us, so it was good to come down here, get the result in the way we did, and move on.
A lot of speculation, of course, all year about Conor Callan. Would he come back? Wouldn't he come back? You were always adamant he would come back. He has come back, and was it 1-5, 1-6 tonight? Impressive performance, to say the least, for him.
Yeah, there's always speculation when it comes to Dublin football. Conn was always going to be coming back. He just missed out in the league campaign because of injury. It was a fairly substantial injury, so it was great to get 70 minutes into him tonight.
Can I ask you about your goalkeeping choice today?
What about it?
I mean, you would probably have expected Evan Comerford to play, and if he wasn't, you would have expected maybe Michael Shield to play.
Yeah, well, Evan has been injured, and thankfully he's back on the training ground, and We just decided to go with David tonight, So that's the nature of what we're about, is trying to induce as much competition into the system as we can. And it was good to see our two keepers go toe-to-toe. Michael's a great keeper as well, and David got the nod for this one.
Yeah, that was... Desi there talking to Declan Drake. So, Sean, it was a comprehensive win, I suppose, is the way to describe it. They're facing Meath, of course, next in the semi-final. But getting back to Whizzing Ways, and probably a bit of relief for Desi to see them performing in that way.
Yeah, absolutely, Reg. And you have to say, like, he has been saying all winter that you know, that he's missing X and Y, and all of a sudden, you know, he produces a Dublin team that starts with Conor Callaghan, who scores 1-6. Fantastic. He leaves James McCarthy on the bench and Niall Scully because people were criticising his bench, and then he introduced them. But look, 124 to 4 points was very, very comprehensive. He'll be happy. Are the contenders again for the All-Ireland, Reggie? Probably are, but not the number one or two. Kerry are still there, and perhaps even though Tyrone had a setback, you know, they're probably still ahead of Dublin. But are Dublin in the chasing pack with Galway and Mayo? They absolutely are.
Is it better in many ways that maybe they're coming in under the radar, and everybody's like an awful lot of talk about they're finished and they're this and they're that, and it's rubbish talk really. They're still quality footballers right throughout that squad, and a good setup. So like, maybe it's better for them that they're coming in under the radar and nobody is giving them a chance.
Yeah, that it's certainly new for them anyway. But I had a good look at it back at it last night. The last time they won the All-Ireland, where they beat Mayo, there's still nine of that team playing, and nine of them that played won nine All-Stars the same year. So there's very few teams in the All-Ireland that have that 60% of their starting lineup are All-Stars. So Dublin, if they're coming in under the radar, I think the next day, Reggie, will have a big bearing on it. They're playing Meath in a double header in Croke Park. It'll be very interesting to see how they perform that day. Meath definitely have that game in their sights, because they played very well against Dublin last year and almost caught them the second half. So Meath have been eyeing up this game for a long time. It'll be very interesting to see how Dublin perform, particularly in Croke Park. And particularly, Dublin will have to start one or two new players, you know, Tom Lahiff, Young Gannon, you know, players like that. So it'll be interesting game, but it'll see exactly where Dublin are after that game, Reg.
Yeah, absolutely. OK, well, look, the Hurlers, they made it 3 wins from 3 in their round robin last Sunday, defeating Westmeath in Mullingar, 27 points to 116. 8-point win for Matty Kenny's Blues. They've moved on to 6 points now with score difference of plus 11, but still two tough ones to come.
Yeah, they've probably the two hardest ones to come, Galway and Kenny. You'd have to say, Reggie, that last week just wasn't good. They were a point up at half time. They were going through the motions, and next thing, Westmeath got a goal, and all of a sudden, then they lifted their game. You know, so you wouldn't be happy with the performance. But yet, Reggie, if you go back 3 or 4 weeks ago and said, after Dublin's 3 games and taking in the game away to Wexford, that there'll be 6 points, you'd be extremely happy with it. I mean, Galway are only 5 at the table, Kilkenny are 4, and Wexford are going to struggle now to qualify because they're only 3 points, and Wexford will genuinely have to beat Kilkenny in Nolan Park the very last day of the season.
What did you make of the little incident between Cody and Shefflin last week? I didn't think it looked great for Brian Cody, but he was probably just in the emotion of the moment.
Yeah, everybody's talking about it, and look, people are trying to probably brush it under the carpet. Brian will know when he looks back at it, it didn't look good, and it didn't make him look good. And it probably didn't make Kilkenny Hurling look good either, if I'm being honest, Reg. They're two soldiers of 20 All-Irelands as a manager and a player together. There should have been a small bit more respect to it. I do accept that Brian Cody, having been behind for all the game, all of a sudden got himself level and lost to a controversial free, but taking it out on Henry Shefflin was the wrong way to approach it.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm sure they've forgiven it now at this stage. It's water under the bridge. They're two stalwarts, the pair of them. The under-20s, the Dublin under-20 hurlers started and ended their provincial campaign. Narrow single-point loss to Wexford last Monday in the southeast.
Yeah, very disappointing, Reg. Putting up 114 in an under-21 championship or under-20 championship probably just isn't enough. We got a great chance. Ken McSweeney, with about 10 minutes to go for a goal chance. The poor lad, he'll have sleepless nights over it. In fairness to him, he had a good game overall. But the talking point was the very last puck of the game. Dublin got a line ball on the 45. The ball, I don't know how it hit the post and came back in. It was curling. It should have hit the post, got inside the post. It actually hit the post, didn't go in, came back. Wexford picked the ball up in the square, and that was the winning and the losing. And the good thing from a Dublin point of view, Dara Purcell and David Crowe, you'd have to say, both from the Kilmacud Crokes, two young lads to look out for going forward.
Excellent stuff. The Miners, of course, fresh from that brilliant win over Kilkenny, they're back on the road this afternoon. They're going to Tullamore to face Offaly in the Leinster semi-final. How do you think that one will go?
Yeah, I'm heading the minute I finish here, Reg. I'm off. It's 12 o'clock starting Tullamore. Tullamore, which is a very early start. They have a great chance of progressing. Offaly, the opposition were in the tier below, and they're after having a great win against Leash by 3 points in Tullamore, and they were drawn in the quarterfinal away to Antrim, but they put up 322. Now look, they're playing in a tier below where Dublin were playing. Dublin's, you know, preparation for this is an away game to Kilkenny and a home game to Wexford, which they were pipped by a couple of points. Well, actually 1 point in the end. So look, Dublin probably have the better preparation matches, but I will tell you one thing, Offaly will leave everything on the field down in Tullamore at 12 today.
Excellent stuff. Okay, we look forward to that one as well. Okay, you mentioned the men are taking on Meath next, and indeed the women are taking on Meath later this evening as well, and I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Aisling Cleary, PRO of Leinster Gaelic Football Association. Good morning, Aisling, how are you this morning?
Good morning, gentlemen. Ready and raring to go for this weekend's crazy weekend of football, but definitely looking forward to Parnell Park this evening.
Excellent stuff. Okay, well, before I get chatting to you, let's have a listen to Mick Bowen before we do that.
Just when we thought we were king of the castle, along come Meath, and fair play to them. They've been fantastic and they've held their and worn their crown well to date. But the summer's a different matter, and this Saturday, and regardless of what happens on Saturday, we play them, well, we play them or Westmeath, and one would fancy Meath at this point in time, in 3 weeks' time again in a Leinster final. So whoever gets that opportunity, you know, last week essentially has guaranteed us a position there, because somebody else, you know, unless it's a drawn game, but the likelihood is there's going to be a winner. So look, we look forward to Saturday night and probably a free shot for two teams, you know, one way or the other, but at the end of the day it's a rivalry now, and you don't want to be on the receiving end of it regardless who's playing.
Aisling, it's a rivalry. That's a bit of an understatement if ever there was one. Dublin-Meath games, it's going to be a tough one. Meath, such a powerhouse in ladies football as well, but no doubt the Dubs' chances are very, very strong.
It's interesting. Tyrone Quinn interviewed Emma Duggan during the week, and she mentioned this little rivalry as well. I think it's anything but little. It's massive. And you know what? It's great for the province that there's, no disrespect to any of the other counties, but a Dublin-Meath rivalry back top billing in provincial football is great to see. It's going to be a really intriguing battle this evening. Obviously, Dublin are coming off the back of a big win against Westmeath last weekend. That was important for them because the last game out, they were obviously shocked in the league semi-final by Donegal. So it was important, I suppose, to get back into winning ways, if you like. And this is Meath's first provincial senior game since 2016. So there was pictures put up online there during the week of that team that played in 2016, and it's obviously completely different. There's a few survivors, but in essence, it's a completely different squad. So it's going to be very, very interesting. This is the third time these two teams, the second time these two teams will have met since the All-Ireland final back last September. It's going to be a very, very interesting battle indeed.
Good morning there, Aisling. How are you doing? Sean here. How are you?
Good morning, Sean. Not so bad.
Everybody's using the word rivalry, and I remember from the men's back in the 90s, there was four games back to back, and there was 250,000 people attended. The ladies' game has really caught on, and the support is unbelievable. In the game tonight, where do you see the key battles, Aisling, and who do you see coming out on top?
There's a couple of interesting squad choices. I was surprised when I received the Dublin team list during the week because Carla Rowe is not named in the first 30, so she won't play any part this evening. She scored 2-5 for them last week. And Hannah Tyrrell is on the bench and she scored 2-9 for them. I thought that was their omission was interesting. But I think Mick Bowen, there's obviously serious fight for a Dublin jersey at training at the moment. And it's interesting to see him shake up his pack. He's obviously looking to see what players he has, obviously keeping an eye on that Leinster final on the 28th of May. I think who picks up Kelsey Nesbitt is going to be a really interesting one from a Dublin perspective. And Kate Sullivan, who on the Royal side pick up Kate Sullivan. She's very, very quick on the wing, and give her half an inch of space and she's gone and she's through. In defence, Leah Caffrey has been absolutely rock solid. Herself and Orla Nolan, and Hannah Tyrrell as well. Actually, they picked up Team of the League awards last night in Croke Park. So they're more silverware to add to their cases. No, but Leah has been immense all season for them at fullback. So she'll probably be picking up Stacey Grimes, and that'll be interesting. If Vicky Wall, I don't think she'll play. She's named a play at corner forward, but I don't think she'll play there. I think she might be back out at the half forward line. But the interesting thing about this Meade team, I suppose, is that typical positions don't really count. They move and they weave, and it's very difficult, I suppose, to pin opposition down. It'll be how Dublin can deal with that again, like the All Ireland final last September.
Yeah, and Vicky Wall, as you mentioned, she must be one of the best players that we've seen in the last decade in ladies football.
It's an absolute powerhouse now, to be quite honest. And how she plays tonight, I mean, she lifts everybody around her, do you know? She can set up attacks. Her relationship that she has on the field with Emma Duggan is incredible to watch as well. They just seem to be so aware of each other on the field. And that obviously has had huge success for Meath over the last couple of months.
Time to turn our attention to football now, and I'm delighted to be joined by the one and only Alan Cawley. Good morning, Al. How are you?
I'm good, Reggie. How are you?
I'm brilliant. I before we get into the football, I've no doubt you enjoyed the snooker last week. You're a big fan.
Yeah, I loved the snooker, Reggie. It was absolutely brilliant. And in some ways, I was kind of glad for Ronnie to win it, because I think the only stick that people were beating him with was the fact that obviously Henry had won 7 and he had only won 6. And for, I suppose, some people to be deemed the best player ever to play the game, you probably have to have the trophies to match up with that as well. But I never felt that. I always felt he was the best ever, and I think most of us did. But the fact that he has the 7 now and equals Henry, it was great for him. And what was lovely as well, Reggie, because I wouldn't be his biggest fan, but what was lovely afterwards, I thought, just seeing the human side of him and kind of that emotional side of him as well, because we don't normally see that. And I think that that was nice to see, because I suppose Steve Davis made a good point after the final. He's been carrying a lot over the years, and pressure and different things he's had to deal with has been deemed the greatest ever. So it was a nice moment, I thought, afterwards, him and Trump.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, time for the football now. I mean, what a night it was. There's, you know, this league, we're chatting about it being exciting and everything else. And Derry's blushes were saved a little bit last night. Some were saying a bit of a fortunate penalty that they got ensured them getting a 1-1 draw with Bowes getting the lead after 14 minutes. There's absolutely no doubt that was a surprise result, dropping 2 points there for Derry City against Bowes.
Yeah, especially at home, because obviously their home form has been very good. They've scored 11 goals in the last couple of games as well. So people are suggesting that they'd get the 3 points against Bohemians. But Bohemians are a decent side as well, Reggie. I know they've been inconsistent and up and down, but you just don't know what you're getting from them. And when they're on, they're really good, to be fair to Bohemians. So I think that was a good result. More so for them in terms of going forward. That's the standard they've set now, and they should be picking up points. Like, what's killed Bohemians is draws against the likes of UCD and Finn Harps. Silly, dropping needless points that they don't need to. And they'd be further up the table. And they're still in a good enough position to be challenging for Europe. But they'd probably be the head of that chasing pack had they not dropped those silly points. So a good point for them. I thought it was a dodgy enough penalty as well. I only saw the replays and it looked soft enough. But Derry, after going to keep tabs with Shamrock Rovers, you have to be winning your games at home. So they will see that as 2 points dropped.
Absolutely. You know, Rovers went on and got the job done. We expected that against Finn Harps. 3-1 victories puts them a point behind Derry. Shelburne, you know, they've had their ups and downs this season. No question about it. Damien Duff has been centre of talking about the fact that he's building a squad, building a team together. And they got a result last night, which they will be very happy with. The 2-1 win over Sligo. Sligo are no slouches, as we've said many times on this show. They've dropped a little bit in the last few weeks, but that's a good victory for Shelburne to get them back on track.
Yeah, great victory, Reggie. I was in Talca Park and they played well. It's probably the best that they've played all season. They were absolutely brilliant, totally dominant in the first half, scored 2 great goals, Jack Moylan and Sean Boyd. And they were really comfortable at that stage. Sligo changed it up a little bit and brought on a couple of more attacking options in the second half and put them under a little bit more pressure. But it was a comfortable victory and a great victory and a much needed one, as you say, because Shelburne have been in the doldrums. I think they've lost three on the bounce coming into this. Their home form has been poor as well. But that's a huge victory, give them huge confidence. And I just felt with the team he named last night and the personnel, it gave them a much better balance, particularly in midfield. JJ Lunny played really well. Shane Farrell dropped into kind of a right side of midfield. He played well, and Conor Kane also on the left. So it was a really good performance. Lots to build on now for them. And that, again, come back to my point about Bowes, that's the standard they've set now. So they have to be matching that week after week. Plus, they had the added bonus of the great news of the campaign with Save Talca Park as well before the match, Reggie. Mm. That was announced, obviously, during the week that will be saved as well. So there's a lot of positive things going on with Shelburne at the moment, mainly off the pitch as well. But it's important that you do your business on the pitch also. And that was a really good victory for them last night.
Absolutely. Dundalk had a 2-2 draw at UCD. Another mistake from them. UCD bottom of the table. But managing to get a 2-2 draw with Dundalk would be, I feel like, a victory for UCD. But very poor from Dundalk.
Yeah, that's 2 points dropped massively. They were 2-0 up, Reggie. Man sent off and then they got clawed back to 2-2. And UCD have some good attacking forwards, but they've been the whipping boys. They're really struggling in the league this year. So that's 2 points drop, because Dundalk had got themselves into a really good position before the Knights play in third and going about their business nicely. But Stevie will be very disappointed with that result, especially when they're 2-0 up. I know they went down to 10 men. Andy Boyle got sent off, but you still should be seeing it out. So yeah, that's definitely 2 points dropped in their kind of campaign to get into Europe.
Rovers at home next week to Derry, am I right in saying that? So that'll be some clash.
Big one next Friday, Reggie. Yeah, that's the two of them. Now before that, they've both games Monday night as well, so it's a big week for both clubs, and they've a tough game Monday night. Derry are playing St. Pat's, and obviously St. Pat's had a huge victory last night, 4-0 beating Drogheda as well, so they'll go into that game with a lot of confidence. But of course Derry beat St. Pat's 4-0 last week also, so they'll have to bounce back from that St. Pat's, and they'll certainly feel a bit wounded going into that match. So that's a big game Monday night. Shamrock Rovers are playing Sligo Monday night. Now I watched Sligo last night against Shelburne and they were really, really poor, and I watched them last Friday against Shamrock Rovers and they were only okay in that match as well towards the last 20 minutes. So I'd fancy Shamrock Rovers to beat them. But next Friday then will be a massive one. Obviously the two of them facing off, and we're hoping Derry can sustain the challenge because no one else is going to get near to Shamrock Rovers. So we're pinning all our hopes on Derry to give us some sort of a title race. And so far they've played their part of the bargain, and hopefully they can keep it up. But that's a massive one next Friday, Reggie.
Absolutely. Well, we look forward to that. Okay, during the week we were treated to some wonderful football. Liverpool, they had to kind of make their fans a bit nervous, didn't they? They couldn't make it easy on them for a while, but in the end, proving their class and coming out on top, no question about it. But what a game it was between Real Madrid and City. Just hard to even dissect what happened, and Guardiola must be still scratching his head going, what happened?
Yeah, the Liverpool won, as you say, Reggie. They ran out easy winners after an iffy first half, let's say, and 2-0 down. But I'm not sure people were really panicking. They still had the quality. I think Klopp got stuck into them at half-time and he brought on Diaz, made a couple of tweaks. I'm sure it was just a case of changing their attitude more than actually changing the personnel, even though Diaz played great when he came on. And they ran out easy winners. But yeah, Wednesday night, it's hard to comprehend this Real Madrid team, Reggie. There's no logic to it whatsoever. Like, it's not as if they've been brilliant in the games and they're showing their true quality and that's how they're coming through. They're literally hanging on in games and fighting back when it looks like they have no hope. And the other night was just, I thought I'd seen it all up to now, but that was just incredible, because even if you look at the game towards normally like that in a cup tie, when you're chasing a game, the last 10-15 minutes you're throwing the kitchen sink at the opposition and you're doing everything in your power and you're throwing players up top and the other team might be hanging on. There was nothing like that at all. Man City were in total control. If anything, it looked like City were going to get another one with the two breakaways with Jack Grealish, obviously the one off the line, and then Courtois pulled off a great save. And then out of absolutely nowhere, Reggie, I suppose it's the reason we love sport and we love football. A ball goes into the box, little lad Rodrigo nips in, and all of a sudden there's life in it again. But even at that, I still didn't think they'd go up and score, because that was their first shot on target the whole 90 minutes, was that first goal. And then obviously a cross into the box, a minute later, another goal. It was just unbelievable. And I think not alone will the damage, obviously them getting knocked out City, but I think the damage that might do to them psychologically in the league campaign as well could be a massive, massive blow, because you know yourself in games like that, Reggie, if you're ahead and you lose out when literally victory is taken away from you right at the death, that it's very, very hard to come back from that. And I think it'll give Liverpool a huge lift, obviously in the Champions League, but definitely in the league as well with the games coming up this weekend.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, there was a few people saying during the week that Liverpool would be much happier to have Real Madrid in the final than City, because, you know, City would be, I don't know, more challenging for them. But I don't know. I think that Real Madrid team, they just never seem to give up, you know?
No, I don't buy into that at all, Reggie. No matter who to play it, obviously City was going to be a difficult tie, but Real Madrid would be difficult as well.
Yeah.
But I think there's big decisions to be made. I know we'll preview it in the coming weeks, but I think there's big decisions to be made for Ancelotti in terms of the team selection, because you look at that young lad he brought off the bench towards the end, Camavinga, was absolutely outstanding. Rodrigo came on against Chelsea and got the winning goal as well. Then he came on the other night and got two. So there's big decisions to be made, because as much as I've loved Kroos and Modric and Casemiro over the years, and they've been fantastic, they won't have the running power to try and deal with Liverpool, because they're so quick and so strong in that midfield area. So it'll be interesting to see what he does, even if he might play Modric and Casemiro with Camavinga or something. But it's a big decision to make, and it'll be interesting to see what he does, because that young lad that came on, Camavinga, he's only 19. He's absolutely outstanding,
brilliant.
Reggie.
Yeah.
Brilliant, brilliant player. And he's going to be a star going forward. And it's one of them where he's just too good to leave out. I know he had a huge impact, and people might say, well, take him off the bench, but you could be two or three down by the time you bring him off the bench. So I would start with him, you know. He was absolutely outstanding, but we've all that to look forward to. But I don't subscribe to, might even be difficult, because as you says, Real Madrid, we thought they were out against PSG, we thought they were gone against Chelsea, we definitely thought they were gone against Man City, yet here they are still alive and kicking. So there'll be a lot of fears for Liverpool going into that, definitely.
Yeah, well, they have Spurs, of course, today, so that'll be a chance for them to go ahead, albeit briefly, because City are at home to Newcastle. You'd expect them to get the job done there, but that title race, it's really coming down to the wire now, just a point between them.
Yeah, four games, it's brilliant, Reggie. I'll be glued to the game tonight now against Spurs, tough tie, but I just think Liverpool have their tails up, they've so much momentum, they're so good, they're so strong. Even though I like Spurs, I think Liverpool will take care of them. I'm more interested in seeing just the reaction from Man City tomorrow against Newcastle, because that's a tricky enough tie.
Yeah.
Newcastle have picked up in the last few weeks. Eddie Howe's done a decent job there and got them into the top half. But it's more about Man City and their reaction, and just see exactly where their heads are at, because I know it was immediately after conceding the two goals that you go into extra time, but their heads were absolutely gone at that stage, Reggie. So yeah. I know they've had 2 or 3 days to maybe try and deal with it, but I still think it's going to take them a little while to get over the manner of that defeat the other night.
Thanks for listening to Dublin's Talking Sport on Sunshine 106.8 from myself, Ken and Reggie. Have a good weekend.
Ha ha ha.